So, Bill, would you tell us what these are, just briefly?
Sure. LC 1502 requires public employers to provide paid health care insurance coverage to retired public safety employees until retired employees are eligible for Medicare coverage. LC 2221 directs the Department of Corrections and the Oregon State Hospital to establish sex offender treatment programs. Conduct and establish sex offender treatment programs. And LC 2222 specifies that reasonable self-defense is not abuse for purposes of laws requiring reporting of abuse of individuals who are elderly, mentally ill, developmentally disabled, or in a long-term care facility. Requires the Director of Human Services to establish an advisory committee to advise the director regarding consents of behavior management plans and appropriate responses to threats of force, and it directs the committee to review certain allegations of abuse.
All right. Bill introduction.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I move introduction of LC 1502, 2221, and 2222 by the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Walker moves the introduction of LC 1502, 2221, and 2222 as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. That is done. And let me see. I think Secretary of State, how many folks do we have in the Secretary of State's office? Anybody else who's not with the Secretary of State's office on 101 or 136? All right. Okay. Well, why don't we start with Senate Bill 136? Try to speed through that. I understand there are some amendments, and maybe we can get through that relatively quickly. So who do we have?
On Senate Bill 136.
All right. Peter, is it Threlkel?
Threlkel.
Well, I was close, huh? Somewhat close. I've seen you before.
Yeah.
General Government Committee.
That's exactly right. Corporation Division.
All right. Gentlemen, introduce yourself for the record. Tell us what you want to tell us.
Okay. Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkel. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State. It is my pleasure to testify before you today on Senate Bill 136. A little bit of background. The Corporation Division, one of our primary programs is the Uniform Commercial Code program at the state level. What we do there is we receive filings of security filings on personal property from individuals. It's what we're looking at here is property that's not affixed to real estate. Generally, it's personal property. A good example would be if John Deere Corporation sells a riding lawnmower to an individual on contract or on credit, John Deere would want to perfect their security interest by filing a UCC financing statement with our office. That perfects the lien. It puts John Deere, the secured party, into position with other creditors that may have a claim against that debtor at some future point. In July of 2001, the revised Article 9 went into effect in Oregon. This is the Model Act that came out from a national level. And what that did was it limited the Secretary of State's ability to exclude frivolous filings from the UCC record. The most common type of frivolous filing that we're dealing with today is a redemption filing. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to acquaint you with the theory of redemption. And I first must apologize if you're not already familiar with this, but I have to take you down this path. The scheme of redemption takes its root from the Posse Comitatus in the late 1970s. Over the years, there have been many variations and proponents of this scheme, including the Freemen of Montana and other radical common law movements. From the U.S. Department of Treasury, they published a fraud warning called Bogus Site Drafts and Bills of Exchange Drawn on the Treasury. They offered a very stripped down and probably, I think, the most concise definition of what redemption is, and I'd like to quote that for you. The theorists claim that when the United States went off the gold standard in 1933, the federal government somehow became bankrupt. Then, with the assistance of the Federal Reserve Bank, the government converted the bodies of the citizens into capital value. And this was somehow accomplished on the open market. Then, after following a complicated process of filing a UCC document with the Secretary of State's office, the individual is able to redeem his value by filing a site draft on their Treasury direct account. The Treasury, I'm sure, would like me to point out that they view this as entirely fraudulent and frivolous and has no basis in fact. One of the common parts of the scheme is that participants will also file false IRS forms 8300 and currency transaction reports in the name of law enforcement officials and other public officials who they seek to harass. In our office, a typical example of what we see is someone will come into the office and they'll present UCC filing statements. And on that statement, what they will do is they'll name themselves as the debtor and the secured party. As collateral, they'll list a combination of their Social Security number, their birth certificate, their driver's license, all their worldly goods and possessions, past, present, and future. And they will even list their body parts. They claim to be a transmitting utility, not because they're a railroad, a power line, or a gas pipeline, but because they claim to transmit steam and electricity. The transmitting utility is good until canceled, so in essence, this allows the filing to be permanent and forever. Right now, under the existing law, the Secretary of State has to accept these filings. We have no authority to decline them.
Okay, that's enough. I don't think anybody in the committee would disagree. Anybody have a question about that? The issue? We don't want people jacking with the system, right? Okay, you guys can stand down. Brad Swank, come up here. You're neutral. Brad, how are you today?
I'm fine. Chair Menace, how are you?
I'm just peachy.
Chair Menace, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel for government relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm not here about the general purpose of the bill. There's just a small technical issue that I'd like to raise at the end. If you look on page 12 of the bill in section 4, the new 5A that they're adding, they've put in an appeal provision and something that we also think of as a resource allocation provision, if you will. This appeal provision provides that when a decision is made by the Secretary of State, the people are going to, if they want to challenge, they go to court, Circuit Court in Marion County.
Right.
This petition in the Marion County Circuit Court shall be set the matter for hearing at the earliest possible time and shall give the matter precedence over all other matters except older matters of the same character. And in C, you find that there's de novo review then at the Court of Appeals. While this may not be the Cadillac of appellate procedures, it's certainly the Buick Regal of appellate procedures in terms of use of court resources. This is not a bill where there are probably going to be a lot of challenges in terms of number to the court. There may be, there may not be. We're not to tell. But this is also not going to be the only bill where you're asked to look at an appellate procedure. And there's a range of appellate procedures and a range of process that you can approve, all of which cost resources, ranging from a contested case proceeding in front of the agency that then goes to the...
Brad, at the risk of being rude, you want to work with Secretary of State's office to fix this problem, right?
Well, I just want to raise the issue so that you know that this particular section...
You don't want to fix the problem, or is there a problem?
I'll work with Secretary of State's office.
We don't need a lesson on all the appellate issues. We just want to... if there's a problem and you want to fix it, then we'll send you off to the Secretary of State's office. You can do that.
Okay.
You want to do that or not?
Sure.
You do. Okay. Is that okay with you guys?
Sure.
All right. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Okay. Public hearing. Next bill. Senate Bill 101, public hearing. Who's on my list there? Same folks? Anybody daring to come up here and testify? Okay. Andrea Meyer, you're out here. Signed up last. You're not. I'm not calling you. You guys always sign up last. You're like your defense. Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman, my name is Thomas Castle. I'm an assistant attorney general. I've been asked here to testify this morning. My honor to appear before you to give you a brief analysis of the bill. One of the reasons I've been asked to testify is because some of my testimony is anecdotal. The bill is designed to protect public servants from when they have been threatened by members of the public after the public servant has been performing his or her job. The bill itself permits the public servant to file a petition in the circuit court seeking an injunction or basically restraining another individual who is engaged in any of the activities, criminal activities listed under Section 1 A through G. What the bill does not do, it does not expand a public servant's rights to obtain some sort of injunctive or protective relief. What it does is it streamlines the current processes. It provides a less cumbersome method for a public servant to obtain protection. That's essentially what it does. There may be some concerns raised concerning any absence of any specific procedure that might take place in front of the court. Clearly, anyone against whom a restraining order is sought has the opportunity to appear and be heard in at a meaningful time in a meaningful manner.
All right. Good.
I can just tell you anecdotally, if I could just...
Sure. Go ahead.
Several years ago, I represented an SCF worker, Services to Children and Family. She had removed several children from an abusive parent's home. That evening, she went home. She was a single mom. She was actually originally a native of Israel. She heard someone trying to break into her home, which she thought was someone trying to break into her home. And about 11:30 at night, she went out. She looked around. She was very frightened. She got her children up. She didn't see anybody outside, but when she opened the door, someone had spray-painted a red swastika on her door. She was extremely frightened, scared, as anyone would be. She immediately got in the car and drove away. As she was driving away, someone began following her very closely, just about ran her off the road. She went and contacted the authorities. She wasn't able to identify anyone as the perpetrator. She couldn't actually file charges. She had strong suspicions that this was the same individual who she'd seen just a few hours earlier, who she'd taken the child out of the home. That was a situation where we had to go forward. After numerous court appearances, we were finally able to get the relief we needed to protect this individual. But this particular bill would streamline that process and correct that situation. I could tell you other stories. I don't know if you want to hear them or not.
I don't.
Thank you.
Sir, your name is?
Ted Lawrenson, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry.
What do you have to tell us, sir?
Well, briefly, we believe Senate Bill 101 would provide a useful tool to the Department of Forestry. We do work hard to make sure that confrontational issues are minimized. We've got, I think, a good reputation for positively working with a range of folks in our programs. nonetheless, it's fair to say that forest resource issues are things that generate a lot of emotional feelings. We certainly have experienced behaviors that Bill would help address. Within our arena, it's fair to say there's an increasing number of situations where civil disobedience is occurring, and some of those efforts are directed at employees. And it's very clear that there are a number of individuals that believe that it is in their best interest to be disruptive of both the state's business and to harass state employees in that process. For example, on a recent state timber sale, the AZ Line Fin Department employees had a number of daily verbal threats, recurring unwanted telephone calls. Basically, protesters were spitting at employees, throwing unsanitary materials at employees, and that sort of thing. And we've also had harassments occurring at auction sales. That has included verbal threats and people showing up with hoods covering their faces and threatening and intimidating state employees. We've also had similar sort of issues where a public individual exhibited hostile and threatening behaviors at a number of Board of Forestry meetings at the board members, and in particular had a visit to our Board of Forestry member's home that was unsolicited and fortunately didn't escalate into violence, but the Board of Forestry members felt very threatened by this individual, and to a large degree that was one of the reasons why this bill was spurred for that particular incident.
Right. A question for the Attorney General, Deputy Attorney. Why just these crimes?
These appear to be the crimes that would most likely occur when a public servant is being harassed or threatened in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if these are all misdemeanors, I believe.
Right.
And law enforcement is generally sympathetic,
right,
and would be helpful, but
right,
oftentimes these kinds of crimes are not a high priority for law enforcement, especially
right,
when we don't have evidence that is very compelling or there's
right,
no smoking gun.
Right.
But these are the kinds of crimes, particularly telephone harassment, menacing,
okay,
threatening to obstruct someone's public service.
So someone calls up and you know who the person is, they say, "I'm going to kill you." Is that covered?
Yes.
Threat to kill under which one?
Menacing.
Under menacing, okay. I'm going to sexually assault you. Menacing?
Menacing.
Okay, all right. All right. That's what I want to make sure exactly happened to me. People would threaten and want to kill me, I imagine that.
Well, we provide protection to you, Chairman. I mean,
that's why I carry a Glock. Okay. Andrea, your turn.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Farrell.
Just a question relative to the issue there. Will prosecutors prosecute these crimes? It's been my understanding or impression that it's difficult to get prosecutors because they have some misguided apprehension that these are somehow civil libertarian issues or free speech questions, or if it's connected with a political issue like the ancient forest question, they're afraid to tackle these questions. And we have some statutes now that are designed to be protected. You can't get prosecutors to prosecute these things.
Well, I can tell you that they're generally not a matter of high priority, but on the other hand, if in fact a crime has been committed and there's probable cause for that prosecutor to believe that a crime has been committed, and he or she believes that they have evidence sufficient to convince a jury or judge beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime was committed by an individual, I think they have some duty to go forward and try to prosecute the case. However, prosecutors do have great discretion in deciding which cases they will prosecute and which ones they won't, and some of those decisions are based on the availability of their resources, which are, as we all know, constantly dwindling.
Mr. Chairman, I think I got the answer I expected. It's really a matter of putting the tool in the statute.
But see, this bill doesn't really say anything about prosecuting the crime. it just allows for the court action to enjoin.
Right, the injunction.
The injunction.
Right.
So,
if I may, I could just point out to you that the standard required in this particular bill is by preponderance of the evidence rather than proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
And that's the principal difference between this and a prosecution in a crime. I think that, when there's very, very solid evidence available out there to go forward and prosecute a crime, I would expect that that's what would happen. I think this bill is designed to address the situation where the evidence is not as solid, perhaps, as a prosecutor would like it to be before he or she went to court.
Right. Okay. Great. Andrea, I'm waiting with bated breath to hear what you have to say about this.
I'm not sure what this is.
No,
it's
Amen. Okay.
Good morning, Chair, Minutes, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We just have a concern that what's not clearly stated in this legislation is a sort of the due process element entitled to someone who might be a restraining order sought against them, that there's a notice and an opportunity for them to be heard.
Well, okay. Where's the Attorney General guy? It would seem to me that there's already a process that exists for.
There are. I think we're all just not clear. We assume there's a process, and this does not amend a particular statute. It's a new.
I understand, but I'm just wondering if that's even necessary because there is a process that exists.
There does need to be a process.
There does.
Sir, yes, absolutely.
How come you left it out?
I think.
Sorry,
it's an easy fix as to why we left. I'm not certain. I can't answer that question, but I could tell you that it's an easy fix. We'll be glad to help in drafting some additional language in the bill that makes sure that anybody against whom a restraining order is sought does have the necessary protections. I agree. The bill does have to comport with due process. It does have to give individuals the opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time in a meaningful manner.
Okay. But there's no generic process out there when someone files a petition like this?
No, not that I'm aware of, Chairman, but I could be mistaken.
There is no specific process. We would need to put one in there, just basically that they would have to have a right to a hearing.
Okay.
And
great, we'll do that. Anybody have a question, concerns, et cetera, et cetera? How long do you think it will take you?
A week.
1 week. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 101? If not, we're done with that public hearing. Thank you very much. We'll see that in a week, hopefully with an amendment that satisfies the ACLU, friend to all persons. Now, public hearing on Senate Bill 86, Senator Ringo and Representative Richardson. That's a neat little way of doing it. Just staple your card.
I did that.
Oh, I thought the dentist did this. Hi, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, I'm Senator Charlie Ringo, Senate District 17. This bill would change the statutory dollar amount of ORS 20.080 from $5,500 to $10,000. That's all this bill does is change the dollar amount. And I'd like to explain a little bit about what the statute accomplishes and why that's a good thing. ORS 20.080 is designed to help facilitate quick resolutions of very small claims. That's all it's for, is resolving very small claims as quickly as possible by allowing attorney fees to a prevailing party. I want to talk for a little bit about when attorney fees are allowed under the statute. Typically in the United States, attorney fees are not allowed to the prevailing party in litigation. Both sides just have to pay their own attorneys as they go. We've created some statutory exceptions to help consumers on small dollar items. For example, under a landlord-tenant law, for example, if a tenant, let's say the landlord wrongfully retains the rent deposit, that kind of thing, attorney fees could be allowed if a lawsuit is brought. Wage and hour law. So there's lots of little examples to allow somebody to have access to justice, because unless they can afford an attorney, or an attorney will somehow give their time to the case, there simply won't be a mechanism for the aggrieved party to obtain justice. And that's what attorney fee statutes are designed to do, and that's what this one is designed to do. It was originally contemplated to deal with motor vehicle accidents. It relates to personal injury and property damage. And I think that's probably where it's applied 80-90% of the time, although it can be used in other contexts of personal injury or property damage. I think it would be helpful for me just to give one example, an anecdote of, for my practice, of where it was used to good effect. I had a client come into my office one time who was a Hispanic who didn't speak English, who said that the cars had stopped out on the road. He brought his vehicle to a stop, and he was rear-ended, and it caused about $2,000 worth of damage to his vehicle. And all he wanted was the insurance company for the other driver to pay that money, to pay $2,000 for his damaged vehicle. And they wouldn't pay for it. And so that's why he came in to see me. And this statute allowed me to represent him so that he received justice. I sent a letter to the defendant and to the insurance company, and essentially the response I got back from the insurance adjuster on this case was, well, you know, we don't feel good about this. This might be fraud. And I said, fraud? What are you talking about? There's two Hispanics are rear-ended by four Vietnamese. None of them speak English. They can't even talk to each other. They can't even set up fraud. The adjuster said, well, you know, they're getting pretty sophisticated. My response is, you know what? If they were committing fraud, they would at least be claiming an injury. They'd be claiming a sore neck or something. All this guy wants is his vehicle paid for. And the insurance adjuster would not do that. This statute allowed me to send a 10-day demand letter and then to file suit. And then in the course of the litigation, when they took my client's deposition and they found out he was just an ordinary guy driving down the road and was rear-ended, they finally woke up and said, you know what? We are going to have to pay on this one. So they ended up paying this guy his $2,000, and they paid my attorney fees, which by that time were probably 5 or 6 hours worth. If not for this statute, this guy would have had to, A, look at going to small claims court, and he never would have been able to navigate that, or B, he would have had to find an attorney who would do this for free. Normally, attorneys handle large cases like this on a contingent fee basis or a percentage, but no attorney is really going to be interested in going all the way through a jury trial to get one-third, a contingent percentage, of $2,000. It simply doesn't pencil out. And that's what this, that's an example of where this is a very powerful statute. And if it didn't exist, folks like my Hispanic client would never get justice.
All right.
The way this works is that in 90% of the cases, when the 10-day demand letter is sent, the insurance companies say, you know what, we better evaluate this claim quickly and make an offer. And when they make an offer, then that puts the pressure on the plaintiff's attorney to say, you know what, if I don't beat that offer, then I won't get paid on this case. And that's why it facilitates small claims to settle quickly, which I think it happens 90-95% of the time. These cases are never filed because after that 10-day demand letter, there's a reasonable offer made, and that's the end of the case. So one of the effects of this statute is to reduce the burden on our courts by facilitating settlements in these cases. I want to talk real briefly about what the opponents are going to say. First of all, some of them simply don't like this statute because it's a tool to use against wrongdoers, and it's a tool they would rather not plaintiffs have. Other opposition will come more from the mechanics of it. For example, they may say 10 days, the 10-day demand letter, that's not a long enough period of time for them to evaluate the case. And frankly, I think that there's maybe some merit in that. Maybe that 10-day limit should be pushed out. Maybe they want a copy of that letter sent to the claims adjuster so that the claims adjuster can be put on notice more quickly. I think there are, if their opposition to this bill is presented in terms of the mechanics of the statute, I think there's room for discussion and room for negotiation. But the bottom line is that it's a very useful statute that's allowed thousands and thousands of Oregonians to receive justice where they never would have received it otherwise. Now, I want to make just one final point. There are rare instances where someone will bring a claim for, say, $1,000 worth of damage, and by the end of the case, attorney fees have amounted to $20,000 or more. And they'll say, see, that's not right. Attorney fees are driving those type of disputes. Well, when that happens, it's because the defense never properly evaluated the claim. They never made a timely offer. And if they want to avoid that situation, all they have to do is make a timely evaluation and make a fair settlement offer. And that resolves 99% of these disputes. That's the end of my testimony. I welcome comments from Representative Richardson.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson. I represent District 4 in Southern Oregon, but I'm coming before you today as an attorney with a small law practice in Central Point, where I've practiced since 1979. Our practice is primarily involved in consumer law, and I have to confess that I haven't tried a 20.080 case in several years, but I'm experienced in how this section helps the common person, and so I speak for the benefit of the citizens. There's three reasons why I believe that it's appropriate for Senate Bill 86 to be passed. The first is that it will help lessen the clog in the courts. We've cut back funding because of necessity to the judiciary, and it's going to cut back staffing, and it's going to make it more difficult to take cases to court. And so it'll be important for us to do those things that will help cases to settle. This statute, 20.080, promotes settlement of cases. The second is it helps injured parties to more reasonably value their own claims. It costs the same to try a case if it's worth between $10,000 and $20,000 as if the case is a $30,000 or $40,000 case. And so by raising the limit to $10,000 in statute 20.080, it will allow a plaintiff who has a case where it may be worth $10,000 to $20,000 to reconsider the value of that case, file under this statute for a lesser amount, and get the case resolved without tying up the time and the resources of having to take a case all the way through depositions and trial. And thirdly, it helps insurance companies to value and settle small cases. Several years ago, I was involved in a situation where within 2 weeks, I received I had two clients that came in. Both had property damage cases of less than $1,000. They were involving the same company, the same adjuster. I called the adjuster and said, look, I'm not interested in taking these cases. I've checked the liability. Everything's clear. Pay the property damage and be done with it. And the adjuster said, I'm not able to do that. There needs to be comparative fault attached to all of these cases. And I said, well, this is, you know, one was like $600, the other was like $750. These were poor people. The value of the car on the open market was almost nothing, but it was all they had, and they needed to have it fixed so that they could drive their car. Anyway, I was told that there was going to be comparative fault attached to that, which means they wouldn't get the ability to fix their car. And I said, well, if you're going to do that, then I'm going to file under 20.080 and take you to court. That was done. Our law firm tried both cases. Both were successful. The cars were fixed. Our fees and one was like $2,500 and the other was like $2,300, but the insurance company had to pay our fees, their own defense attorney's fees, and to fix these two cars. And the result was that position was no longer used in our Medford office, and there was no more of those kinds of positions that came to us with similar cases. 20.080 helps the people to get their cases resolved. It helps insurance companies to evaluate small cases without thinking we can just resolve this thing for whatever we want because no attorney's going to take it. It is a valuable statute for the people. It helps settle. It helps relieve the stress on the court system. And I would support and hope that you would also support raising the limit to $10,000 so that we can have the benefit for the people.
All right. Any questions? Representative, thank you. Senator?
Thank you.
Panel again. And John Powell, you're technically first on our list here. Do you have a cadre of individuals that you'd like to bring up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell. Before you today, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and North Pacific Insurance Company. With me on my right is Tom Mortland, Vice President of Claims at North Pacific, and my left is Steve Merle, a claims attorney out of Eugene for State Farm. Mr. Chairman, before I turn it over to Mr. Mortland, he does have a statement that he could pass to the clerk for distribution.
All right.
I just want to make a couple notes about the previous two witnesses' testimony. In fact, every case that they talked about is currently covered under Oregon existing law with a threshold of $5,500. That was increased just session before last in a compromise over this statute. I think our testimony today will be to indicate that $10,000 is not a small claim. And I think the two company representatives here will be able to demonstrate that with some facts and information. So, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like Mr. Mortland to introduce himself.
All right, speak. That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Mortland. I'm the Vice President of Claims for North Pacific Insurance Company and Domestic Property and Casualty Insurance Company headquartered in Portland. North Pacific is now a member of the Liberty Northwest Group. I am also an attorney licensed to practice law in Oregon and Washington. I graduated from Willamette School of Law in 1976, practiced law in Oregon from 1976 through 1995. During my years of practice, I represented both insurance companies and their insureds, as well as individuals making claims against insurance companies. Both in my legal practice and my employment in insurance claims, I've had experience with claims which have been the subject of attorney fees claim pursuant to ORS 2080. That experience leads me to believe that passage of Senate Bill 86 and increasing the monetary limit included in this statute is not only inconsistent with the purpose of the statute, but would actually defeat that purpose. The Oregon Supreme Court discussed this purpose in 1956 in the case of Colby versus Larson. The court noted that ORS 2080 was enacted for the purpose of encouraging the settlement without litigation of meritorious tort claims involving small sums. Amending this statute to make it applicable to claims up to $10,000 would not only go well beyond the purpose of the statute, but would be contrary to that purpose. Rather than discourage litigation, increasing the limit would actually encourage parties, and especially their attorneys, to file lawsuits and to litigate rather than settle claims. Here's why. Attorney fees are generally not separately recoverable in tort claims, which include claims for property damage and bodily injury. In most such cases, attorneys are paid a percentage of the amount recovered pursuant to a contingency fee agreement. ORS 2080, which currently applies to claims of $5,500 or less, is an exception to this general rule. It provides an incentive for tort feasors and their insurance companies to settle these claims. More to the point, the statute provides a disincentive to litigate in that attorney fees can be assessed on top of recovery if the pre-litigation offer is too low. The statute operates to serve its intended purpose. In my experience, insurers are very cognizant of this statute and the motivation it provides to make adequate offers on small claims. Where I work, we're well aware that failing to make an adequate offer on a 2080 case can result in payment of both the claim itself as well as substantial attorney fees, fees which might well exceed the value of the claim. For cases above $5,500, the dynamics are and should be different. In this range, we're no longer talking about small claims or routine claims. In this range, the difficult case is one for bodily injury, where reasonable people often disagree about the fair settlement value. For these higher value claims, the playing field is balanced between claimants and attorneys seeking damages on one side and defendants and their insurers on the other seeking to limit damages. Where negotiation fails to resolve these differences, alternative dispute resolution comes into play. The possibility of litigation looms as well. Most such claims are resolved informally without the necessity of litigation and without a lawsuit appearing to be an attractive alternative for either party. Passing Senate Bill 86 would change this existing practice dramatically. Claims in the range of $5,500 to $10,000 would routinely be the subject of 10-day demands pursuant to this statute and the subject of lawsuits if those demands are not met. Unlike small claims where damages are readily ascertainable, $10,000 claims such as bodily injury claims reasonably require more than 10 days to investigate and evaluate. Met with a 10-day demand, an insurance company would face the choice of paying that demand without a reasonable chance to evaluate it or facing a lawsuit and attorney fees if the demand is not met. This gives plaintiffs and their attorneys a strong incentive to make early demands and to file lawsuits when those demands are not met. Purely and simply, passage of this bill would encourage litigation. More civil lawsuits would be sure to follow if this bill becomes law. I'll conclude by mentioning numbers which illustrate the dramatic impact of this change. In 2002, the average auto damage claim paid by North Pacific was around $2,600. The average property damage claim paid was around $3,500. In 2002, approximately 95% of claim payments made by my company in the state of Oregon were less than $10,000. Clearly, raising the limit of ORS 2080 would extend its application well beyond small claims. This is inconsistent with the purpose of the statute. Passing this bill would also be inconsistent with current practices which encourage settlement and discourage litigation. I urge you to reject this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Morrell. Any questions of Mr. Morrell? Senator Ringo.
Senator Starr can go first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see Senator Starr.
Mr. Chairman, this 5,500 limit that was set, when was that established?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I believe that was 1999 when the limit was raised from $4,000 to $5,500.
That pretty well answers my question. I was wondering about inflation and the relation to changing from 5,500 to 10,000. Thank you.
And following that, do we know how long $4,000 was the limit of statute? When was that first put in law?
Mr. Chairman, John Powell, for the record. Again, it was 4,000 for quite a while, but I can't remember exactly when it was changed.
All right, cool.
It seems like at one time it was 3,000 and then it went to 4.
Okay. Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your figures in the last paragraph about the average auto damage when paid, that only refers to the damage to the vehicle. It doesn't refer to the total claim, does it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I'm Tom Morley. That's correct. That represents payments made for claim components, so that would represent the amount paid for property damage, or essentially the damage to the auto, right, as separate from, for example, bodily injury.
Right, and this statute could also be used to pay for medical expenses, true?
It can, and in fact is.
Right, and we've seen a dramatic increase of health care costs in the last 5-10 years, haven't we?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, and do you have the figures with you as far as the total average claim that you pay, not just focused on the auto damage?
Are you asking about a combined total per
correct
claim?
Correct.
I don't have that with me available. I think we could certainly determine that. I can tell you that HIP payments, with personal injury protection, which represent the no-fault payments that are a mandatory part of auto liability insurance in this state, also are in the $2,500 range for an average payment.
Okay. When you say 95% of claim payments in the state of Oregon were less than $10,000, you're just talking about the auto damage. You're not talking about the entire claim.
No, I'm talking about the average payment by category across the board. So that would include auto damage, it would include property damage, it would include bodily injury, it would include medical expense. Those are coded and categorized separately, so it's a combined total, and then the average compared. So that was the 95%. It does include bodily injury.
When a claims adjuster at North Pacific receives a 10-day demand letter under 20.080, that adjuster knows very well they need to make a quick settlement offer, don't they?
That's true.
Okay. And are the vast majority of cases resolved based on the offer that's made?
The offer that is included in the demand letter?
Correct.
I would say so, because under the current practice and under the statute as it exists now, most of those claims, as the example you gave did, concern auto damage claims or property damage claims that are at the low end of the damage spectrum as opposed to bodily injury claims.
Okay, but I just want to confirm. I mean, I use the words vast majority, and you don't dispute that. The vast majority of claims do settle without litigation after ORS 20.080 demand letter is sent.
Yes, it currently exists. That's true.
All right. And so just by raising the limit from 5,500 to 10,000, we're increasing the number of claims that would be settled under that mechanism, aren't we?
Well, Senator, I respectfully disagree, and I do in the sense that difference represents the difference between the average auto damage claim, the average property damage claim, and the higher value bodily injury claim. So as I see it, we're migrating from the routine auto claim, the routine property claim, into the bodily injury spectrum.
Just one more, Mr. Chair.
That's right.
If there were accommodations, for example, to lengthen the 10-day period, would you find this change more acceptable?
As it relates to bodily injury claims, yes, but extending that within, I think, defeat the purpose of the original statute, which I don't have a quarrel with. I think it serves its intended purpose, and to extend the 10 days to 30, for example, would take away from what you, again, described as a very functional way of dealing with the low-end claims. So it would also dilute that piece of the statute and that operation of the statute.
But if it were extended to 30 days, say for the higher end claims, that would be a useful way to that'd be a useful approach to look at.
That would address one of our concerns, because the fact is, from our perspective, presented with bodily injury, a demand for bodily injury claim and settlement of that claim, it takes more time to assemble the medical records, evaluate it, and make an offer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a comment. I think the 10-day period is a fairly short deadline, and I think there's room for discussion on it.
I want to get to Mr. Morrell, and then I've got some questions about the whole process, claims process. Mr. Morrell.
For the record, I'm Steve Morrell, Chairman Minnis, and I'm an attorney hired by State Farm out of Eugene, Oregon. I think Mr. Mortland's testimony speaks to most of the points. There's just a few things I would like to add to what he did have to say. One of them is that the current statute at $5,500, there's a twist that we see in practice with the statute where there are claims that have total payments currently that are more than $5,500 that you'll end up being affected by the statute. And by that, what I mean is a person comes into our office, had a claim with one of our insureds, liability is relatively clear, and I pay this person's property damage claim. Maybe I pay $3,000 or $4,000, whatever it is, some figure that I pay. That person may have a slight injury, may have a PIP bill or two, and actually make a claim with their PIP carrier. So we're probably up to anywhere from $3,000 to $4,000 already. What we've been seeing happen is at that point they may get representation. A 10-day demand may come for $5,500 for the bodily injury only, saying that I've already been paid my PD, my PIP carrier has the claim for reimbursement directly against you for the medical bills, so I'm just asking for pain and suffering of $5,500. Well, already you have a claim that's out of the range of the $5,500 set by the statute. It doesn't take much to see that when you raise that to $10,000, you're substantially raising the range of claims. Our data with State Farm is very similar to that of North Pacific's as far as the number of claims. In the year 2002, we paid 24,520 liability claims with auto here in the state of Oregon. Of those, 91% of them would have fallen below the straight $10,000 threshold.
So what you're saying is that you already paid on one portion of the claim.
Correct.
And then you get, under this statute, a claim that purports to be under the $5,500, but when you aggregate them, you're over that amount.
Correct.
There's nothing in law now that requires that the entire claim, bodily injury, medical, or property, be included in the original demand.
Chairman, there's nothing right now when you've already paid that.
Right.
When the demand just comes and says, I'm only going to sue you for my general damages, bodily injury,
right. Then
it fits the pattern for attorney's fees presently.
Okay. So one alternative would be to put all of those things under that,
correct,
that cap, so that you have to have all of it claimed at the beginning. Or if you've already paid a portion, that portion would be included. All right.
And there's only one other thing if I could mention. The statute that's currently written is not a prevailing party statute. The plaintiff is the only one who can recover their fees. If a defendant is successful in resisting a non-meritorious claim, they're out their attorney's fees. And you don't get your attorney's fees as a defendant.
All right. You're sorry to hear that. Okay. Help me understand, we have mandatory insurance requirements. So, assumedly, everyone who's driving a vehicle has insurance. Now, where is it that you end up with somebody who's not represented by an insurance company who would otherwise pay the damages to the injured party?
Chairman, what will happen is there's a variety of coverages. most people's own cars are paid for under their collision coverage, which has an optional coverage. On some older cars, it doesn't really pay to have that coverage, so you will be self-insured for your own property damage. And unless it's someone else's fault that you can recover from, then you're not going to recover that damage.
Okay. Or it might be my deductible. I carry like $1,000 deductible. Right. So. Okay. Did you, John?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to conclude, and I apologize for this hoarseness, but the referees at the Oregon State game Sunday were terrible. Just terrible. And I think I got them to go back to Palo Alto where they must live and have students at Stanford. But, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make two points. One, most insurance claims settle promptly, whether they're subject to this statute or not. The vast majority of claims settle promptly, even if they're not subject to this statute. And I think that the key part of this bill is what is the definition of a small claim. And as you've heard here, clearly that a $10,000 level is not in the number of claims filed and at what level considered to be a small claim. And that's why we would resist, even if we were able to change the statute on the number of days of notice and that sort of thing, that the statutory level of $10,000 is too high for a statute that only allows one side the advantage of recovering fees.
But I'm sitting here thinking, why haven't we capped attorney's fees in this case? Why would you have a case where you've got a claim of $5,500, but you might have attorney's fees that are far in excess of that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think back to Mr. Mortland's testimony. The purpose of the statute, again, was to target only the small claims and provide an incentive for the insurer and the defendant to reach a settlement with perhaps the penalty of having to pay those fees. And that's why we object so strenuously to increasing it to this amount.
Senator Ringo?
John, I'm sure you do object to increasing the amount, but the example that I gave during my opening discussion where my client had been rear-ended and the adjuster just refused to pay, my recollection of the damages were about $2,000. Given the increased medical expenses and the increased cost of repairing a car, I mean, there's many claims that push the $5,500 limit. And what is a plaintiff to do in that situation? I mean, how are they going to get justice when you have an adjuster that refused to evaluate the claim responsibly and the damages are more than $5,500? How is that person going to get justice?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, I think that the system provides for, again, continued options, and I don't know in your practice at what threshold you establish for taking cases, but I think there are a lot of cases filed between a $5,500 and a $10,000 level.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I completely agree, and that's what this bill would be attempting to address, or situations where the adjuster, I mean, my practice is that there are still many adjusters that refuse to deal fairly with people. They just, not all of them, I mean, 90% of them don't, but there are enough that do, and those are exactly the range of cases that this bill would intend to bring in and require that they make a quick offer and a fair offer, and then they don't have to for cases within those ranges. So that's the difference.
Well, is there an appeal process when an adjuster refuses to budge and a claimant asks that someone about that?
It's called a lawsuit. It's called a lawsuit.
Well, but other than a law.
No.
Chair Minnis, I'll be happy to respond to that. There may be internal processes where, and it happens on a regular basis, where recourse is sought to someone else in the company, the supervisor, the manager, and that's a possible avenue. Like all insurers, we're obliged to comply with the fair claim practices, standards, the rules and regulations promulgated here and everywhere that require us to deal with claimants and with insurers and according to certain standards. So we have those responses. And as Senator Ringer points out, the courthouse is there, and people can file lawsuits and resolve their differences. And in higher-end claims, that's what often happens. People reasonably disagree about the value of a higher
a more serious bodily injury claim. Those are the cases that tend to go to court, although even a high percentage of those end up settling.
All right, we've got a few other witnesses.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you very much. Anna Butterfield was here. I think she had another hearing to go to, but there's John Clements from Safeco Insurance Company.
I also got to send a written testimony.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm John Clements with Safeco Insurance Company. And I've been an adjuster and a unit manager and in the claims process for the last 23 years. I'd like to address a couple of points that were brought by or questions that were asked. And one had to do with when the $4,000 threshold took place. I have some old testimony here that indicates that it went up to $3,000 in 1975. And I believe it went up to $4,000 in 1985. I apologize if I'm a little nervous here.
No, just relax. You're doing fine.
Okay.
I get nervous when I'm on that side of the table, too, by the way.
Thank you.
I don't know what it is. It's like, it just happens.
I also testified before this committee in 1999. When the request at that time was for an increase of $7,500, and that was Senate Bill 50, the increase was limited to $5,500. And one of the reasons for that is because that was the amount of small claims courts, the threshold in small claims court. And I don't know if that was the reason for that, but that was, I'm sure, in part why that particular amount was selected. In my experience the last 4 years, there hasn't been anything, any societal changes that would warrant another increase from just only 4 years ago. Certainly, inflation hasn't been a factor in the last 4 years. And Senate Bill 86 would ultimately increase the cost to ratepayers because insurance is a pass-through mechanism. Also, Senate Bill 86 lacks balance and equity. In Washington, for example, they have a $10,000 threshold, but it allows attorney fees to the prevailing party. So it's a two-way mechanism rather than a one-way mechanism. It also allows time for a reasonable tender all the way up to 10 days prior to trial. I believe that Senate Bill 86 would also increase litigation and the burden to our courts. And the reason it does that is because the only way you get to the attorney fee situation is by either threatening or filing a lawsuit. Without that trigger, there is no attorney fee exposure. And for the most part, I agree with prior testimony. The parties do resolve claims without giving, without resorting to litigation. 90%+, if not more, 95% of all claims are resolved without any litigation. It increases the costs of settlement as defendants have to pay a premium to avoid litigation. And as you raise the threshold, you also will increase the resistance because we're no longer talking about small claims. As a result of Senate Bill 86, you would have a likely increase in appeals of arbitrations, again, because the amount is so much larger that while someone may be willing to part with $3,000 or $4,000, it becomes a little bit harder to part with larger amounts. And finally, the impact to the insurance business and the rate-paying public cannot be minimized. And I agree with the percentages that were given before. Safeco's experience is that well over 75% of all physical damage and bodily injury claims would now fall under this new threshold. And to echo what prior people testified to, a $10,000 claim under this statute is not really a $10,000 claim. Someone with $6,000 or $7,000 in medical bills can have that handled through PIP arbitration mechanism and still file a claim for $10,000. They can also have their physical damage resolved prior to this. So essentially, you've got what could be a $20,000, $25,000 claim with falling under this statute. That ends my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
All right. Great. Senator Rago.
Just a couple. What you just said about the $6,000 or $7,000 in medical bills handled through PIP arbitration, I mean, many PIP carriers don't handle those bills through PIP arbitration, and then they would be included under the 2080 limit, correct?
No, they would not. The Oregon scheme is through... it involves intercompany arbitration, and most, if not all, of the carriers in Oregon are subject to this mandatory arbitration process, so they would not, they would be resolved through their own mechanism.
Well, I think when you have a subsequent witness up, you may be contradicted. I mean, I understand about PIP arbitration, but when a 10-day demand letter is sent, that letter has to include all the damages and can't just assume that medical bills are going to be handled through PIP arbitration.
No, they do not. It's the choice of the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney, and they can choose to only include general damages and to arbitrate. And that's because companies have, in an effort to resolve matters, they have signed on to intercompany arbitration.
Maybe we're just misunderstanding each other, but I disagree with part of your conclusion. But just one more question.
Sure.
In your experience as a claims adjuster, when you would get a 2080 demand letter, you make every effort to make a quick settlement offer, correct?
I do, but in most cases, in a significant number of cases, I don't have the information necessary to make an accurate judgment. The 20.080 demand can come without any medical documentation. We may have been unable to obtain a factual statement from the injured party because they were represented. So there's a lot of factors that prevent us from making an accurate judgment as to the value of that claim.
But your goal is to make a quick offer.
Our goal is, and I hope you accept that as at face value, but our goal is to always reduce the cycle time on all claims and to pay them as promptly as possible. There's absolutely no benefit to not doing so.
Yes, but if you could answer my question, please. When you get a 20.080 demand letter, that gives you a special incentive to evaluate the claim quickly to make a quick offer. Isn't that fair?
It does provide incentive, yes, to evaluate quickly, but it's no additional incentive than we would handle any other claim.
All right.
No further questions. Yeah. I just want to add, not an argument, it seems to me that if you did get this 10-day, you got a 10-day timeline to get this 2080 demand letter, it's almost as if the insurance companies would have to respond in some way with some kind of an offer. I'm just trying to figure out whether that's almost an incentive to take a bad offer or something out there just to satisfy the statute. So, okay. Are you?
I am done. Thank you very much.
All right. Sean Miller.
Mr. Chair, if I can bring Gary Rankin.
You bet.
Thank you. Gary. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the National Association of Independent Insurers, Association of Property and Casualty Insurance Companies doing business in the state of Oregon. On behalf of NAII, I'm before you today in opposition of Senate Bill 86. Not to repeat what the prior witnesses have told you, but I do want to reiterate that this statute was created and has been an effective tool used to leverage prompt settlement of small damage claims, the key being small. When I surveyed our members of member companies, the average amount that claims covered with the increase to $10,000 would be in the 80% range of company claims. And so, again, this increase, one company, for example, expects about a 66% increase of the claims covered from the $5,500 threshold to the $10,000 threshold. So obviously this increase, we believe, far exceeds the original intent of the law, and that was to leverage these prompt settlements of very small damage claims. In conclusion, we oppose Senate Bill 86, and I would at this time like to introduce Gary Rankin with Allstate Insurance.
My name is Gary Rankin. I've been with Allstate staff counsel for 14 years. I've been licensed to practice in the state of Oregon since 1978. A large portion of my practice deals with the 2080 issues. I think from my vantage point, I would agree with Senator Ringo that the main purpose and the philosophy underlying the statute has and always has been for the prompt settlement of small claims. And I think the issue is going to be what's the definition of a small claim to follow the basic underlying philosophy of the 2080 statute. And I think really what it is, as Senator Ringo said, is to handle the type of cases that seem to drop under the contingency fee radar, that because of the size of the claim, a plaintiff's bar probably would not want to invest time and effort in that type of a case because the payoff is just not economically feasible. And so the two competing issues would be what constitutes a small claim. I believe that the $5,500 limit probably accomplishes what the statute was designed to do. The $4,000 threshold was in place for a long time, and then again it was modified to $5,500. And I guess my experience from the $4,000 down change to the $5,500 modification, the changes that I saw was that the $4,000 case that existed that had existed before the modification or amendment to $5,500, that $4,000 claim became a $5,500 claim. The exact same value, as soon as the statute was changed up to $5,500, that very same claim became $5,500. And I suggest if you do move it up to $10,000, that $4,000 claim that 3 years ago or 4 years ago was $5,500 will be presented and characterized as a $10,000 claim. It's simply the statutory maximum. All of these smaller claims will be booted up and bootstrapped up to the statutory maximum. What I see happening from the change of 4,000 to 55 is really a change where the plaintiff's bar is punting on the economic damage aspect of the case. And as you've discussed, the way it stands now, it's not the total claim. And so a plaintiff's attorney can be sitting with $5,500 in non-economic damages in the 10-day letter demand letter, but also on the other side have $10,000 to $15,000 in medical expenses. And the change that I saw with the change of $4,000 over to $5,500, the claim really is couched in the $5,500 non-economic damage claim, and no pursuit or mention of the $10,000 or $15,000 in medical expenses, which might also be in the case. That's the change I saw. I guess my situation or position would be, why $10,000? If $5,500 was appropriate last time it was amended, what has happened? What is the motivation for bumping it upward as easily as $12,000 or $7,500, unless there's some underlying data or problem or reason why these smaller claims need to be increased? I suggest that it seems to be working as it is now at $5,500. For my situation, again, I would suggest that perhaps keep it at $5,500 without some motivating factor to bump it upwards, but change the 10-day demand situation. As it stands now, plaintiff's attorney simply has to write a letter to the insurance company that says, pay me $5,500. There's no obligation to submit medical documentation, wage loss, or anything. And that letter then puts the insurance carrier on a fairly short time frame to evaluate the claim and make an offer. And the statute, again, does not require, and we've run into attorneys that refuse to submit medical documentation or anything substantiating why this case is worth $5,500. And so the short timeline, I think maybe the letter should be modified to along the line of uninsured motorist proof of loss, where along with the 10-day demand, you also have to supply supporting documentation, which would allow the insurance carrier to properly evaluate the claim. In that case, it would probably prompt more settlements of the $5,500 claim that the statute is to get rid of or settle. Is again the way it stands now. It's 10 days. Pay me $5,500, or you're going to be exposed to attorney's fees. And so, without an underlying basis for bumping it up to $10,000, I suggest we should keep it at $5,500. I haven't seen any great change at all in changing it from $4,000 to $5,500. But I would suggest to prompt settlement, give the insurance carrier some basis to evaluate and settle the case at $5,500. And that would be, again, some type of proof of loss to the insurance carrier. And I think that's what I have.
Senator Walker, and then I'll get to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That last comment that you made has me a little confused, mm-hmm. because I wrote my notes that you said, you know, what has caused this, what is the need out there to go from 5,500 to 10,000? Things are working fine. We don't need to do that. There's been no studies. Yet then you turn around and say, well, I think there should be changes to the statute as it exists now. So you're telling me two different things, and that's not appropriate.
Okay. Okay, I'm just...
So kind of tell me why you're doing that.
Two issues. One would be the necessity for raising the threshold to 10,000. But the later comment was really designed by what I see problem with the existing statute itself, and that is that the insurance carrier on that 10-day demand, which starts the attorney's fees running, there's no obligation on the part of the plaintiff to submit any supporting documentation. So I was really commenting on two issues. I don't see the need to increase the value of that, raise the threshold for the right to attorney's fees. I do see the need to perhaps modify the statute itself to require at least some documentation to be supplied to the insurance carrier to evaluate. And so I think rather than raise the limit as a motivation to get these cases settled, I would suggest keeping it at the same level, but change the statute itself to give the carrier the opportunity to settle the cases quicker and more economically for both sides. So I'm sorry if that seems inconsistent, but I was talking about the need bill is to raise it, but I see the problem the way it now stands.
I understand. You don't want to raise it to 10,000, but you want to make it a little more difficult at the 5,500 level.
I don't think it's difficulty. I mean, the insurance carrier, the difficulty now is, again, what the threshold for this for the attorney's fees issue is simply pay me $10,000 or pay me $5,500. All I'm suggesting is prompt settlement would be if, in fact, along with the demand, there's some underlying documentation to allow the carrier to evaluate the claim to get it settled quickly.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could continue, I would suggest that if we raise the claim to 10,000, that we provide that additional protection.
Protection for?
Provide, require that you show proof of loss. If we're going to increase this from 5,500 to 10,000, then you should provide the proof of loss in the demand letter. That would give you the extra protection that you're looking for in being able to evaluate claims properly. Would that not be correct?
Well. Again, I believe it's two issues. The moving it up to 10,000. Again, what's been previously mentioned is that $10,000 in non-economics plus $10,000 in medical expenses. I mean, you're actually looking at cases that are more than $5,500, or would be $10,000. In reality, you're looking at the change from the 10-day letter. He's evolving to a non-economic damage claim that the insurance carrier is facing, not even addressing or combining the medical expenses or the wage loss, which also may attach to that claim.
Well, that may be the problem inherent in the statute, is that you don't have to include all claims in your 5,500 amount. But I'm not going to argue that point. That's all I have. Thank you.
Senator.
Thank you. Good morning, Gary. Would you support changing this, bumping it up to 10,000 if the demand letter had to include documentation?
No, I wouldn't. Because, again, going down to the basic philosophy of what the reason why it's unusual that attorney's fees are provided in this type of case, it's the smaller case. Mm-hmm. And in my practice and experience, in my reference point, I don't consider a case that has $10,000 in non-economic damages and generally more in medicals as being that small case. I think that type of a case with 10,000 non-economics plus the medicals plus the wage loss, it takes it out of the historical reason why we have the attorney's fee exposure.
More follow-up?
Sure, go ahead, sir.
I mean, you have certainly seen in your practice situations where there was a 10-day demand letter, offer wasn't made, lawsuit was filed. You look at the file and you realize we've got exposure here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a mechanism to make an offer to cut off attorney fees.
Correct.
Right? That's the ORCP 54 offer of compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And that says that from that point, if they don't beat that offer, then they don't get any attorney fees from that point on.
Correct.
And that's a mechanism that allows you to make a realistic evaluation even if an adjuster didn't make an earlier settlement offer.
Correct.
I mean, do you agree? At the start of your testimony, you said that this addressed the problem of where an attorney just couldn't take a case on a contingency basis because it wouldn't pencil out.
Yeah, that's my understanding of why,
right.
And again, why attorney's fees were imposed on the smaller cases to prompt settling. Because
a plaintiff's attorney isn't interested in getting one-third of $5,000 slugging all the way through a jury trial.
True.
And if that's true at say, $5,000, that's probably also true at $7,500, isn't it?
Again, it's pick a number. I mean, it's where you incremented every couple of years based on inflation, or why $5,500 last time, why it jumps up to $10,000. I don't see the reason why the jump. I just don't understand why.
Thank you.
All right. No other questions? Sean, is that it?
Yeah.
All right, great.
Thank you,
is it Bill Simi? Is that correct? Again, I'm probably butchering your name.
Good morning, Chairman and Minister. My name is Bill Syme, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Salem, have been for 20 years. Our organization, OADC, is a not-for-profit organization of over 500 lawyers who primarily defend individuals and companies in personal injury cases and property damage cases and commercial cases. We typically don't get involved in promoting legislation. We may appear from time to time before committees on bills that may have some interest that affect the civil justice system, and I'm here for that reason. I'm not here in opposition to this bill. I'm not here as a proponent of it, but I do offer these observations and to directly answer a question that you had before, Chairman Minnis, about the history of this bill. From my research, it started out the threshold was $500. And in 1955, that threshold was increased from $500 to $1,000. In 1979, that was increased from $1,000 to $3,000. In 1985, it was increased from $3,000 to $4,000. And then in 1999, it was increased from $4,000 to $5,500. Now, you know, ultimately, the legislature is going to make its own mind whether there's been sufficient data or reasons to increase that level, and we're not taking a position on that as a defense lawyers organization. I'm not aware of any empirical data that would merit or justify an increase of almost doubling that threshold in over 4 years, but there may be good reasons, and, you know, ultimately that's going to be a decision that you're going to make. This statute, I think, has a good purpose, and that is to encourage prompt settlement of meritorious claims, and it has been effective for that purpose, and has been put to good use. However, it is also a statute that has been used as a tool and has been abused and has, in some instances, prevented settlement or prolonged litigation. And there are many cases out there where ultimately the amount awarded to a claimant would be, after jury trial, about $1,000 or $2,000, and the attorney's fees are well over $20,000. And these are cases that, for one reason or another, cannot be settled. The defendant or the defendant's insurer makes good faith efforts to try to get things settled and cannot. And literally, the attorney's fees provision becomes the tail that wags the dog in some of these cases. Now, there are abuses that are out there, and I'm going to propose a fix to these problems. And this is a statute that should be fixed. Whether or not you increase the level from $5,500 to $10,000 or somewhere in between. And one is to, and it, here's where the problem arises. The written demand letter is sent only to the defendant, not to the defendant's insurance company. And then on the 11th day, the complaint is filed, and already the right to attorney's fees has been triggered. And in this situation, the defendant's insurer has not had the opportunity at all to settle the case. Second situation would be if the demand letter is sent and it simply says, here's our claim for $5,500, pay it. There's the unwillingness to negotiate off that $5,500 figure and no supporting documentation either by property damage, repair estimates or bills or medical records or things of this nature. No supporting documentation. And, you know, really, anybody needs escrow information if they're going to make an informed decision about whether to settle a case or the amount of the settlement. Now, this is, I think, something that can be addressed by requiring some pre-filing disclosure. And I would propose these changes as being necessary. One is to require that the written notice before the filing of the lawsuit be given not only to the defendant, but also to the defendant's insurance company, if known. That takes care of one problem. The second thing would be to require supporting documentation to be included as a part of that written demand. Gary Rankin mentioned proof of loss. I suppose that's one way to approach it, but I would suggest that you simply amend the statute to say that along with the written demand, you must include supporting documentation. And then you can say supporting documentation in a claim for personal injury would include written reports and existing notations relating to the injuries for which claim is made, unless the plaintiff shows an inability to produce that information. This is something that tracks identically the language of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. It's not overbroad. You would limit the pre-filing disclosure that would be required simply to those medical records for which relate to the claim that is being made. You give them the necessary information to the defendant or their insurance company that's needed to settle the claim. And you're not doing anything that's overbroad or offensive or abusive in any way, because this is all information that once a lawsuit is filed would then immediately be subject to discovery under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. So give them the same information that they would have after the filing of the lawsuit in order to promptly evaluate the case. Same thing, I propose that the statute be amended to include that for property damage claims that you require that some written documentation be given to the defendant or their insurer, such as repair estimates or repair bills, so that they can make that informed decision and value the case. I'd be very happy to work with this committee or anyone else about drafting the SOAR language. I think it addresses a problem that arises in some cases. I don't know how many cases. I can't tell you, but it definitely is an issue out there with the way that some people approach these sort of cases. You file a demand, no information, no willingness to negotiate, and then the lawsuit's filed, and it's away we go. The attorney's fees literally becomes the thing that predominates that litigation. And this is one, I think, very simple way to address that problem. And this is something that needs to be addressed whether or not you increase the limits. I'm certainly welcome to answer any sort of questions that you have.
All right, any questions?
I just have a comment. I think you raised some very valid points, and there are ways to make this more workable.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out in my mind how this statute operates, because it does, at least in subsection 1, talk about the plaintiff plaintiff prevails and they have the opportunity to get attorney's fees. But then it also goes on in subsection 2 to say that if the defendant pleads a counterclaim, not to exceed $5,500. I'm trying to figure out how would the defendant plead a counterclaim for a specific money damage when they're really the defendant being asked to pay. Help me understand that.
I have to address that question, Chairman Dennis. Often, for some reason or another, people aren't able to agree as to who's at fault in causing an accident. So you have a two-car collision.
Right.
The plaintiff says the defendant caused the accident, caused the plaintiff's property damage to their car.
Right.
The defendant says, well, no, you were the one who caused the accident, and you caused my property damage. And so then they bring the counterclaim. The defendant brings their counterclaim against the plaintiff.
Okay, I understand that. But,
okay.
But this statute doesn't just apply to insurance companies.
No, it does not.
This would apply to Safeway. Somebody walks in and slips on a whatever. They file a claim saying, I've been injured because I slipped in the produce section and I've injured my back.
Correct.
And, oh, by the way, I tore my $100 pair of slacks. So they find an attorney who issues the demand letter. So now Safeway is the defendant, and they're being asked to pay money damages for medical and some property damage. That's limited. Now, how would they, as a defendant, make a counterclaim for money damages?
They would not in that situation.
Well, and I guess that's the point I'm making. In subsection 2, in essence, is of no value to someone who's
in that situation.
Right, exactly. So, frankly, this statute looks like the mother lode to me. I didn't know it existed. So,
Chairman, you hit the nail on the head. This is not a prevailing party statute. It's not a loser pay statute. Actually, in 95, when they did the tort reform, and there was a lot of the statutes concerning attorney's fees were amended to make them reciprocal attorney's fees, this statute was specifically excluded from those changes. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here advocating that this become a loser pay or prevailing party statute.
Right.
But I think there are some problems with the way it exists now. Mm-hmm. It should be addressed.
This statute is designed to address the problems where the defense is unreasonable and recalcitrant in refusing to address the responsibilities.
Correct.
To make any settlement offer.
Right, but that's not what it says.
Well, that I think it accomplishes that in many, many purposes. I think Mr. Syme has brought up some
I could
ways.
Make a living off this statute.
Oh, I doubt that.
I bet I could. I bet I could find an attorney that would file all kinds of claims for me. Nuisance claims. You know, 3 or 4 a month. Five. There you go. All right. The statute as it's written, I think you're right. I think there are defects in the statute in its current construction. It just seems to me that an attorney could make a pretty good living if they wanted to filing these claims. The question is, how do you get enough people to file these claims? And I suppose advertising would be one way. This would be an advertisement, you know. Did you know?
Yeah, Chairman.
Mr. Chair, there has to be fault. There has to be injury.
Right.
That statute is designed.
Well, but I understand that. But this is, if you have an attorney and someone walks into an attorney and says, you know what, I slipped the other day in Safeway and here's my pair of slacks that I tore, and oh, by the way, my back is completely thrown out. I've seen my chiropractor, and oh my God, he's telling me I have to be back 15 times. The attorney says, you know what, there's a statute here, 20.080, and by God, I think I can help you. I mean, not to say that an attorney would ever do anything unscrupulous like that, but it just is an open door, and I'm a cop. See, I see evil in everything. You know what I'm saying? This is what I do.
I do, too.
You do. All right.
Chairman Minnis, what I have proposed does nothing to take away from the use or operation of this statute in legitimate cases.
Right.
What it does is it would promote, I think, more realistic settlement offers and give the defendants or their insurers, or if they're self-insured, the defense themselves,
right,
a better opportunity to settle the case before litigation is filed.
I mean, I'm thinking at the very least this demand letter ought to articulate, you know, specifically what potential evidence or proof might exist or documentation, and also it seems to me it should include everything. I mean, if we did raise the level, I think it should include medical, property damage, wage loss, the whole chicken match. But what I don't
I think there's been some misunderstanding on that. I mean, it does. It becomes complicated when there's inter-carrier PIP arbitration. But all damages are included in that unless something has already been paid or unless there's been a letter from the pit carrier saying don't collect our damage.
Okay.
What's that?
I'm sorry. Senator Ringo, it doesn't say that in the statute. If you read the statute, it says damages for an injury or wrong to the person or property or both. So it doesn't say that you have to list it all, but practices, you're telling me what? That you do?
You don't have to specify it, but you can't just add it. You can't add it all on top.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, this is hypothetical, but assume that the insurance company paid a property damage claim. Could there be a subsequent medical claim that comes in after the fact?
If they've already paid, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. And that would not that prior claim that's been paid would not be part of this limitation.
Let's say they haven't paid, and you want to make a claim for $3,000 lost wages, and there's a $5,000 damaged vehicle out there. That adds up to more than the statutory amount. So you can't handle both of those under the statute unless they pay one.
Okay.
Is that right?
Well, typically the property damage claims are settled and the checks are issued, and that reserves the right then of the plaintiff to pursue their personal injury claim later on. As my understanding, the law used to be if you filed the property damage claim for the damage to your car and recovered a judgment there, that would later preclude you from filing a claim for personal injury arising out of the same accident. And that was changed so that you can pursue these actions separately. And I think that's what the concern was that had been addressed by some of the other witnesses, where you have the splitting of the cases, and the effect is that you get attorney's fees on one aspect of the case, where if the cases had been joined, you would not qualify for attorney's fees under the statute. Because we put you over the threshold.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 86? Any other questions?
Well, just Senator Walker. Comment, Mr. Chair. Each legislative session, I pick a handful of bills that I think are going to come back or have been controversial, and I have them in my file cabinet. And I remember this bill from 99, and I did not choose it as one that would come back. So I wish I had not thrown my file out. But I do recall the insurance companies coming and testifying as they have today, which I suspect they did in 1955, 1979, 1985, and 1999. So I do think they think the sky is falling each time we try to raise this, but I appreciate some of the comments that have been made about changes that should be made in the statute.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
And anything to add here?
No, that's it. I think we've covered all the witnesses.
All right. Thank you very much for your attention, and we'll close the hearing.